Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with Dr. Lynn Hume about her book titled Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. EPA encourages utility-controlled refrigerators. At times of peak demand for electricity, do you want your refrigerator to run at the discretion of the power company? The U.S. EPA has revised its ENERGY STAR energy efficiency requirements for residential refrigerators, and it is encouraging the inclusion of, quote, connected features that respond to utility signals to curb their energy consumption. The EPA announced the new requirements on June 27th. Included in this optional smart grid connection for customers to electronically connect their fridge or freezer with a utility provider. The updated requirements raise the bar for energy efficiency in these products and, for the first time, encourage manufacturers of ENERGY STAR appliances to include optional connected features. Currently, consumers must give permission for their appliances to respond to utility signals. In an email to CNSNews.com, the EPA said, "Today, utility initiatives with connected home appliances are mainly in the pilot stage. Product manufacturers and retailers may offer incentives for refrigerators or freezers with connected features. In the future, utilities may choose to offer incentives for customers to purchase products with connected features." So this, as many listeners may know, is the smart meter, UN Agenda 21 smart grid. Opponents of the UN Agenda 21 smart grid, smart appliances, say they don't want this connection and they don't want wireless technology in their homes. The article continues, "The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission is a federal agency that will take complaints on utility smart meters from all U.S. states. Last year, the CPSC recalled 1.3 million GE dishwashers because of 15 reports of dishwasher heating element failures, including 7 reports of fires, 3 of which caused extensive property damage. The other issue, of course, is spying, and now that's not a shock to people that that could happen. With, quote, smart utilities and a smart meter, details of your electricity consumption can be monitored." Well, here we are, the second week of July, July 8th, 2013. Today is a scheduled day for the subway gas attack test. Also, out in the streets as well. The MTA, the NYPD, Brookhaven Labs, Argonne Labs, and Los Alamos Labs are involved with this massive airflow test using the gas sulfur hexafluoride. A lot of people are concerned as they've identified the specific perfluorocarbon, which is sulfur hexafluoride, a non-toxic gas, but it does displace oxygen in the lungs and carries the risk of asphyxia if too much is inhaled. Sally Alcordi joins us to talk more about the subway gas attack test. She's an activist and running for public advocate of New York City to ban vaccines. Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for welcoming me.
You're one of few people here that is doing some investigative work on the subway gas attack test that will involve 21 subway lines in 5 boroughs. A test release of colorless gas will be examined in terms of the airflow. What investigative work have you done here?
Well, I have reached out to many people who are knowledgeable and said, "Everybody descend on perfluorocarbons. Let's see what we can find out." They got back to me, along with my own research, with these very important pieces of information. Okay, from the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, they say that perfluorocarbons persist in the atmosphere for up to thousands of years. So right there and then, whatever is in it is going to be persisting for thousands of years. Now, these tests are in and above the subway. So I'm very concerned in that regard. However, let me tell you, it says also under environment, on a global scale, however, these are greenhouse gases contributing to global warming. They have very high global warming potentials, 5,000 to 1,000 times that of carbon dioxide. Under health, it says, it is known how this may affect health in the long term. Exposure to very high concentrations following an accidental release or in occupational settings could damage the brain or heart. Another source has said, we've known for years that the chemicals called perfluorocarbons, PFCs, can cause thyroid disorders, infertility, pregnancy disorders, low birth weight, and at high levels, liver damage and birth defects.
Listeners, perfluorocarbon is the gas that will be released during these tests this month. In one article, it reads, PFTs present no health or environmental hazard.
Okay. They're suspected to play a role in the ever-increasing rate of reproductive abnormalities occurring across the food chain from frogs to humans. The European Union is phasing out these types of chemicals, but as usual, the U.S. lags behind.
The tracer gases that they plan to release to determine airflow, they have harmful properties, as you've uncovered. So you have that. What have you done in terms of contacting the city about this?
Okay, well, I have gone out to legislators at all levels of government, right up to the president. Initially, I had called my public advocate who told me to call 311. And I said, well, 311 told me to call you last time I called to release the trailers for the cold people on Staten Island. So I thought I'd just go straight to you. However, what they were really saying is get a claim ticket, get a registered number of a complaint, which I found out when trying to reach out to my local legislators. So I did that on July 1st. Unfortunately, I didn't figure out what it is they were trying to communicate until then. So I called and I said, I want this message to go to the mayor. And this is my message. Perfluorocarbons are dangerous to the environment and last for thousands of years. Birth defects, early menopause, brain and heart damage are some of the effects of these gases. I do not consent to gases being released in and above the subways in July in New York City. This is a partial list of negative effects on the environment and the human body. Please let me know when this program has been stopped. Parties involved are the NYPD, MTA, and Brookhaven National Lab.
What can listeners do at this point?
People can do what I have done to call 311 and make a report to Mayor Bloomberg. They asked what category I wanted it under, and I said health. And they said, well, we have environmental or quality of life. And I said, well, environmental, but I really wanted to go to Mayor Bloomberg. This is my whole purpose. So I made the report under environmental. They sent me directly back the same day a service request number, and I took that number and went to my legislators, my own legislators, and said, okay, here's my number. I've made an official complaint. You know already I do not consent, so I reiterate to say I do not consent to this, and I want you to represent as my representative.
Okay, it's important to emphasize you do not consent.
Well, and I've gone out to other people saying, you know, they've given us fair notice. They had two articles in the New York Times. One of them literally said fair notice, the May 14th one by Jim Dwyer. And I said, fair notice requires a response. If you object, you must object vocally, vocalize dissent, say you don't consent. So that's what I have done, and I've asked other people to do as well, because I'm concerned and for good reason.
Fantastic, Sally. I wonder what more information can be gathered from the people at Brookhaven that are also involved in this subway gas attack test. We know it's being funded with DHS money. Is somebody else investigating this?
Yes. Curtis Koff, who wrote a book called Vaccines Are Dangerous, and explores many other toxins as well. He is a researcher, and he has taken the lead to contact the Brookhaven Labs and ask pertinent questions that have yielded very interesting responses.
Great. Okay, we're going to get him on the line next to see what he dug up. Sally Elcordi, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thanks again, Jeff Brady. Always a pleasure. Cheerio.
All right, we're joined with Curtis Kost. He's the author of the book Vaccines Are Dangerous and runs the website vaccinesaredangerous.com. He's also contacted Brookhaven Labs to find out more information about this. Curtis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I heard that you've done some investigative work looking into the connection with Brookhaven Laboratories and this subway gas attack test. Can you tell us what you found out?
Sure. I called the Brookhaven National Laboratories and asked them some questions about these tests. And among the things that I learned was that they're going to be using 7 different perfluorocarbons, and they're not going to be releasing the names of the specific perfluorocarbons that they're going to be using. And this is problematic because some perfluorocarbons are far more dangerous than others. These things have been linked to infertility, menopause, liver damage, thyroid problems, birth defects.
Curtis, your phone was breaking up a little bit. I heard linked to infertility, liver problems, thyroid problems, and birth defects. Okay.
They're also greenhouse gases. So they're a threat to human health and a threat to the environment. And it's critical that the public know which one of these are going to be used. In addition, no public health official has certified that these gases are safe. I asked the Brookhaven Laboratories person who I spoke with, who at Brookhaven has publicly certified. And she, to her knowledge, none of their scientists has publicly certified that these gases are safe. So we have no formal assurance from anybody that the perfluorocarbons that will be used are going to be safe. And this is critical because given the fact that one of the side effects are infertility, and millions of women in New York potentially are going to be exposed to these gases, the implications are horrific. They're not even going to be releasing the locations, which stations they're going to be releasing these gases in. They're not going to be releasing which streets they're going to be releasing these on. And that's important for people to understand. It's not just the subways. It's an above-ground test as well. So throughout the 5 boroughs of New York, people are going to be exposed to these gases. I mean, the long-term effects are not going to be easily assessed given all the secrecy. We don't know the gases that they're going to be using. We don't know where they're going to be releasing it. They're not going to release information on the quantity of these gases that will be released. We don't know how much we'll be putting into the environment. Nobody is certified that they're safe. It's just like we're being used as guinea pigs. And this has been done in the past. I mean, it's documented in literature. Biological agents have been released into the subways before and throughout the country that's proved to be harmful to people. And in the late 1990s, they sprayed New York City with the dangerous pesticides Malathion. I mean, they sprayed directly on the people at trucks going up and down the streets, spraying the stuff on pregnant women, on babies, children, the elderly, the sick, indiscriminately. Hmm. So we have every reason to be very, very concerned about these chemicals and that they're planning on spraying on the public once again.
Curtis, what's our course of action as New Yorkers who are not given fair notice on when and where these gases will be tested in the boroughs and in 21 subway lines?
One of the things I recommend people doing is contacting their elected officials. I mean, the mayor, the Congress representatives, the borough president, and let them know in writing, through email or fax, as well as phone calling, that they do not consent to these gases being sprayed throughout the city, and they demand a formal hearing on the safety of these gases. That is, they need to call for cancellation of these tests until there's a formal public hearing on the safety to the public and to the environment of these gases. They need to spend a little bit of time online researching for fluorocarbons and so they understand the dangers of these things. And we'll be sending out alerts to the public on what we decide to do and strategize. But the bottom line is anyone who has any family members who are a part of the police department, the fire department, the MTA, or others, they should speak to them especially because the average police officer, fireman, MTA worker, and others throughout the city, other union workers and others, they probably have no idea of what they're going to be exposed to. Those are things I recommend. Beyond that, I was told by Brookhaven that they will be giving 24-hour notice on when they will be doing the spraying. Like the first spraying is scheduled, first test is scheduled for this Monday, the 8th. I recommend on those days, at least stay home. Ideally, if you can get out of the city, go to New Jersey or whatever, just get away for that day, that will be great. Otherwise, do not go on the subways. Stay home, turn off your air conditioners. And I would say if you actually, I know this is New York, people really do need to go to work. You absolutely must go into the subways and you must be on the streets when you length of time. I recommend literally buying a gas mask. They're inexpensive. They cost around $30 if you absolutely have to. That is what I recommend because that's how serious I take this stuff. And all of us who are taking action, we all recognize that this is potentially very, very dangerous. So those are some things that I recommend that people do.
Curtis Kost, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Curtis Kost, author of the book Vaccines Are Dangerous, on the subway gas attack test that was scheduled for today, July 8th, 2013. On Sunday, July 14th at 6 p.m., in the Cinema Arts Center Sky Room, Long Island grassroots activists will be presenting a screening of Why in the World Are They Spraying?, followed by presentations from Cindy Pakulis, director of Long Island Skywatch, and myself. There will be a Q&A panel to follow the presentations, as well as live music from Dan Alt, known as DMT, Nick Russell, and Rick Sackett. If you want to join in with like-minded people who are concerned about these operations above our heads, come see us on Sunday, July 14th at 6 p.m. in the Cinema Arts Center Sky Room with the activists out in Long Island. Again, the street address for Cinema Arts Center is 423 Park Avenue, Huntington, New York, 1173. Or you can email them at info@cinemaartscenter.org. That's the word cinema, arts, center, but center is spelled CENTRE.org. In past interviews, listeners may recall the work of Dr. Joe Slate and Dr. Konstantin Korotkov in measuring intention in studying the human auric field. Past guest Jordan Maxwell was one of the first researchers to go into depth on hidden symbols and logos and their effects on consciousness. He repeated to us all, things are not as they seem. Well, today we supplement the discussion with Dr. Lynn Hume, who wrote the book Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. We talked a few weeks ago about projecting the shadow with Laurie Shapira at the C.G. Jung Institute. Well, could those projections manifest outside of the imagination? Dr. Hume will answer that. She's an anthropologist and associate professor in studies in religion at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. She has researched and published on Australian Indigenous culture, contemporary paganism, new religion movements, altered states of consciousness, and sensorial anthropology. Dr. Lynn Hume, welcome to Another News.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeff.
Well, you've written a number of fantastic books, including the one we're talking about right now, Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. Can you describe what a portal is in the context of the book and what made you write this particular type of book?
A portal portal, the way I'm writing about it in the book, refers to what has been called variously as a veil, a door, a gate, a way, a ladder, separating this physical world from other worlds. So we're looking at seeing a portal as something that you move through to get from the physical world to other dimensions. That's basically what I meant by portal. Why I wrote this particular type of book, I'm very interested in the nature of reality and of consciousness and what people believe and the experiences they have when they're in other dimensions. A portal can be a way of altering consciousness so that one feels one has entered into another realm or dimension. My own background, I've been passionately interested in this kind of thing for a very long time. And my academic background is anthropology, and almost everything that I've looked at through anthropology has been on the nature of reality, on rituals and beliefs and practices that people have in other cultures and other religions.
Why is access to portals through consciousness important to understand?
Well, it's a way of trying to understand a lot of different experiences and to expand our knowledge of how we are as humans, the capacity we have to look into our own consciousness, to look at mythology, to look at why people behave the way they do, to expand our knowledge of various things.
In the book, Phantoms of the Brain, that author discussed the brain's ability to change or alter the physical body, such as how a schizophrenic's eye color will change with personality shifts, or as the personality will change, will shift. It really says a lot about the power of beliefs. And in your book, you mentioned W.G. Butler discussing the possibility of a person to build up a thought image that can take on a form and shape of its own, independent of the person's imagination. This is a fascinating area. I wonder if a person's projections can actually manifest into reality.
Yes, well, you've covered a few things there. the eye color changing is interesting because movies and novels have made a lot of that with eyes changing color and eyes becoming luminous in horror shows and things like that. The power of belief is very strong and can affect, it can affect one physically, of course, as we know with illnesses. Beliefs are really important, but we also put our own cultural filters, cultural and religious filters on anomalous experiences. And what we try to explain or how we explain the experience to others might distort the actual experience. For example, I had a friend go to Ireland one time and she said, oh, while I was in Ireland, I saw gnomes. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. Did they have red jackets and green pants? And how big were they? And she said, oh, well, no, they weren't wearing clothes like that. What they were little lights moving across the floor. So what she actually saw were little lights moving across the floor. And she had interpreted that as gnomes because she was in Ireland. Our filters can distort the actual fundamental or basic experience that we have. A Christian, for example, might see a white light. A lot of people see a white light, a luminous light. And a Christian might interpret that as Jesus or the Virgin Mary appearing to them. Yet the basic experience was a white light. So our interpretation distorts the basic experience. So I was very interested in looking at what the basic experience was and if there are any similarities cross-culturally. So that's one of the things in that. Can a person's projections manifest into reality? Good question. In some cases, I think they can. For example, thought forms. Butler discusses the possibility of someone being able to build up a thought image that can take on a form and shape of its own. So thought forms is an idea that has fascinated me for many, many years. I picked up a book in the Theosophical Library that was written by Leadbeater and Besant. The book was called Thought Forms, and it consisted of a lot of images that clairvoyant people had seen. And I thought, oh, that really struck a chord in me. And for a long time, I had that conscious thought of, you know, this is possible, that thought is actually energy that can become a form. And then about 10 years ago, I experienced what it was like to see a thought form. And I woke up, this is a personal account, I woke up in the middle of the night with all the hairs on my body raised, and I got up out of bed feeling quite fearful, and then I saw this thought form and subsequently found that someone had sent it to me, a magician in another state. And so I realized that thought forms are an actual fact, and I had that at a personal experiential level. Butler is a magician, a Western magician. He talks about how it's possible to be able to do this through a series of exercises that you can work on strengthening visualization.
Hmm. Lynn, thank you for sharing that with us, that personal experience. It sounded frightful. What was it that you actually saw?
I saw, I think what was happening was that this person in the other state was very angry at me for a particular reason. And he was sending this to show me that he was angry. It was quite similar to one of the angry thought forms that is illustrated in Leadbeater and Besant's book. Had a lot of orange flashes and brown murky colours, and the flashing was kind of like orange lightning shapes. It only lasted for about 10 seconds, and I know I wasn't sleeping then because I'd got out of bed. Possibly other people have had a similar experiences.
Our past guest, Dr. Carmen Bolter, referenced ancient Egyptian initiates positioning themselves in a sarcophagus and using the pineal gland to trigger out-of-body experiences and would bring back knowledge from the other side. Is that also moving through a type of portal?
Yes, that would be one example. Anything that helps trigger an out-of-body experience could be called a portal. I talk about that in the book, In Portals, about how people can alter their state of consciousness. There are a lot of techniques for instigating an out-of-body experience. So, yes, that is a portal. So, as I said, anything that helps trigger an out-of-body experience could be called a portal.
Our guest is Dr. Lynn Hume, who wrote the book Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. We'll be right back after this break.
Down in peace.
you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Lynn Hume. She's the author of many books, but we're talking about the book Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. You list a number of ways to create a portal in the conscious mind and subconscious as well. The pineal gland is often thought of as the third eye. In your book, can you talk about the known all-seeing eye references throughout history that you list?
Yes. The eye is a symbol of magical perception, and it has appeared throughout history. The Egyptian Eye of Horus, the Eye of the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, the mystical alchemical eye, disembodied eyes appearing on many Buddhist stupas. When you go to Nepal, you see that quite a lot. The omniscient eye of God. We've even got the evil eye that can harm someone, and there are little objects that you can buy throughout Greece and Turkey that are, you can hang in your house. I brought one back with me. It's a glass eye that dispels the evil eye. So the eye is very important in mystical literature. Developing the inner eye is part of shamanic training. For example, the clever man, in Australia, the Aboriginal clever man is a bit similar to the shaman. The Aboriginal clever man acquires special sight during training, and quartz crystals are said to be sung into his forehead in order for him to have the ability to see with the inner eye. And with this inner eye, he can detect illnesses. And they call it having X-ray vision, so you can see through objects. The clever man can also see psychic lights, for example, a light about a dead person's grave through a little time after his death. Burnt, right as the father of a young sorcery victim who called on the services of clever man to heal him, and he said to, quote, stare at the wound, his eyes became glazed and his X-ray vision was centered at the middle of the forehead. So it's often depicted as the third eye between the two eyebrows. It has the ability in a lot of places to detect illness. I'll just read out about the Kung Bushman in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
This is recorded as an experienced healer talking about an inexperienced healer who hasn't developed his qualities properly. So the quote is, you see him staggering and running around. His eyes are rolling all over the place. If your eyes are rolling, you can't stare at sickness. You have to be absolutely steady to see sickness. Steady eyes, no shivering and shaking. Absolutely steady, with a steady gaze. You need direct looking.
You know, it reminded me a little bit of when humans and dolphins are swimming together. The dolphin sometimes uses its sonar to see through the human and can detect cancer and will nudge the part of the body that has a cancerous or there's some kind of injury. The idea of staring at something, there's an increasing function and ability as you continue to stare. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Staring and the feeling of being stared at, that's been written about too. It's interesting to have a connection with another species through the eye too. I had a dolphin come up in a tank. The dolphin was in an aquarium, and he seemed to be looking, eyeballing me. It was quite an uncanny experience.
Yes, dolphins can really make you feel that they're staring right at you. I want to talk with you about the Ouija board. I noticed on vintage Ouija boards, they have a sun and a moon on them, duality. The two pillars as well, the Masonic pillars, Jacob and Boaz. Is a Ouija board a tool for creating portals?
Yes. I would see it not so much the board itself as the act and intention of the players, of the users of the board. So they're focusing their attention on what they're doing, attention and intention. The sun and moon and the two pillars, you could possibly see that as the balance of light and dark in a dualistic way, and that one could refer to dark and light as the left and right path, and the Kabbalistic notion of entering through the middle, or the middle pillar, one must be balanced in order to transcend the physical to the union with the Godhead, that kind of idea. That's possibly how I would see that. The Ouija board itself can be a bit dangerous perhaps to play with. I think you're not, people just play with it as a game, and it shouldn't be used that way, I don't think.
Maybe you should mention that to the marketers of Parker Brothers, who are one of the companies that put out that board game. And you're right, it's not a game. We often hear about it bringing in spirits or entities from the other side. A number of circumstances come together, and intention is one of them. Dr. Lynn Hume, can you tell us about the olfactory portals that you write about and how they were used by shamans to travel the spirit world?
Well, the smell is said to aid communication and to open up the boundaries. So usually they're incense, perfume, burning of certain herbs or plants, and it sets the scene for the expectation of what is about to happen. So smell is a strong aspect of our senses that we seem to ignore a lot in the West, apart from covering up bad smells and enhancing our smells with commercial perfume. But some shamans use the incense and the smells and the olfactory aspect of our senses in order to communicate with the spirit world. And some say that certain spirits are attracted to particular smells. So if they want to call in a particular spirit, they might burn a certain herb or incense. It's the smoke that comes from something like an incense is quite ephemeral. So it can be seen as a transition between the physical and the spiritual, the ephemeral nature of smoke. And it's also a vehicle for the transformation of consciousness. So it has a lot of different aspects like that.
I was thinking it's not so much the smell as the olfactory experience in the brain, but you write about garlic, the smell of garlic warding off vampires and things like that. So it is also the smell.
Yes, well, it's both, because smell can trigger memories, of course. If you smell a perfume that that your mother had, and your mother's passed away a long time ago, and you smell that perfume, then it triggers off your associations with your mother and childhood memories. Or for me, the smell of suntan lotion can take me right back to going to the beach in Sydney. So a smell triggers off parts of the brain that work on memory as well. Also, smells and the herbs or incense that are used to create the smell, some of them have medicinal properties, like garlic's well known for medicinal qualities. So there's a few things in there at play with olfactory portals. For example, a lot of the Wiccan rituals that I've been to, the smell of a particular incense, particularly frankincense, if it's only used in a ritual sense or a ritual scenario, just the smell of incense, of the frankincense, can transport you, can actually start to move you into an altered state of consciousness, where the memory of other rituals that you've been engaged in are put into play. So a particular smell is associated with ritual activity.
Well, Lynn, in the non-drug portaling, as you call it, a past guest, Matthew Deleuze, often discusses the manipulation of crowds through music and the harvesting of their energy. But the location and use of monuments are critical for the whole ritual to take place. Is this something that you've also heard or read about in your research?
The idea of energy comes up a lot. Energy is a force or a power. This is frequently mentioned in different cultures as central to the magical practice, in actual fact. The manipulation of crowds, I wouldn't say that was a portal, but it's the idea of energy is pervasive, actually, sort of amorphous, almost tangible. Like people talk about manifesting in something into visible appearance, and it's using an energy and a vibration. So that is a common notion, actually. As you said about the location and use of monuments, that would be relating to set and setting that I've discussed.
Set and setting, yes, absolutely, absolutely. Can you go down the list of ways to open portals in consciousness, such as using a trance, hypnosis, or even psychedelics?
Okay. The way I've written portals is going through the senses. So there are quite a lot of different ways to alter consciousness. I've pulled out what I see as the major ways of entering a portal through different senses. And, for example, one is mandalas and visual symbols. So then I talk about the eye, the inner eye. And a visual symbol is used in order to pass through the portal. You can use a mandala or a geometric, very plain geometric spiral, or concentric circles or concentric squares, and just stare at those geometrical forms. You can use just a candle. So you're focusing your attention on an object in order to kind of be pulled through the other side. And this kind of thing is used in some Buddhism groups. It's used in Western esotericism. The Sufis use this again also. So the eye and the visual aspects of our bodies can be used as an entrance into a portal. Another is a portal of sound, and this is used to great effect in groups as completely different as the Pentecostals, where there's a build-up of emotion in songs. It's used in drumming. Drumming is the percussion instrument par excellence for taking one through a portal. The repetitive sound, the vibration coming from the drum, and the length of time. If you spend a lot of time just engaged in playing a drum in a specific way, or listening to a drum, or drumming and dancing at the same time. A lot of cultures use that in order to alter their consciousness. I talk about songs in Aboriginal Australia in the book,
mm-hmm.
As a way of a mnemonic device to remember tracts of land and also to go into the dreaming. Another way is through dance and movement. Sufi dance is like a meditation and movement, and the circling, the symbols of the clothing that is worn, the music, the intention of remembering and of union with the divine. That's the whirling movement, the dance, the sound is all involved in that. Another is tactile portals and portals of pain. Some groups use pain as an extreme way of altering consciousness.
It made me think about piercing and tattoo culture. Is there a connection there?
Yes, well, some of the pain that I talk about in portals is, I give a lot of different examples, and one of the examples is medieval mystics who used to flagellate or wear horsehair shirts or engage in painful activities. And you can actually go into an ecstasy through that, especially if you associate pain with a divine personage like Jesus on the cross. You're experiencing the pain of Jesus on the cross. And some of the medieval mystics used that idea, their devotion for God, their devotion for Christ, was through suffering the same pain that the Christ suffered. This has been taken up by modern primitives, such as, I think his name is Fakir in the US, modern piercing. Some of it reflects the ecstatic experience of people in other cultures. For example, there's a festival in Singapore called the Thai Pusam, and there's the wearing of kavadi. It's extreme pain with that. Some of them wear parabolas of steel parabolas with steel points going into their flesh, or have hooks in their back with heavy items, and the hooks are piercing the skin. And you get that also in the sun dance with hooks coming out of the flesh. So the extreme pain can actually alter your state of consciousness, and you have an experience, a spiritual experience. So it can be done in all different ways. But some people who are called modern primitives say that they have spiritual experiences through extreme pain like that.
Our guest is Dr. Lynn Hume. And we're talking about her book, Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. You were going into the sexuality part.
The sexuality part, that is better explained in the book that I've written with Neville Drury that came out this year, 2013. It's called The Varieties of Magical Experience, Indigenous, Medieval, and Modern Magic. And the part on medieval magic is written by Neville Drury, and he goes into a lot of detail about sexual magic.
I was going to ask you about that book. It's titled The Varieties of Magical Experience, Indigenous, Medieval, and Modern Magic. You went down that list of many of the different types of ways to experience portals through consciousness.
Yes, we've mentioned the visual, the sound, dance and movement, and we touched on tactile portals through the flesh and pain. And there's olfactory and gustatory portals, which we mentioned earlier, and sense to open up boundaries. And people see quite a dichotomy between what is a disgusting smell and what is a more pleasing smell. And often a disgusting smell or a foul smell is associated with evil spirits, and a fragrant and pleasing smell is associated with sort of higher entities. So there's that kind of dichotomy. And entheogens as portals, drugs, as another big one, of course. And they're sort of the main ones that I cover in the book. But there would be other ways of entering portals. Perhaps some of the listeners have their own practices.
It seems that we as humans are pretty vulnerable to the altered state of consciousness through drumming, music, a variety of circumstance that could occur unwittingly around us. And we would wonder why we're all of a sudden maybe buying a product or something. Can you talk about gross commercialization and maybe the exploitation of that, of our vulnerability?
Yes. In the first place, it's not really easy to do any of these things. Like all the things I've mentioned in here, it's possible, I think it's possible, but it's not easy. So even if you read about it and you try an exercise, it's not necessarily going to work. It's really quite difficult. And a lot of this might come serendipitously, but most of it is through a long-term study and long-term practice. People can become exploited by gross commercialization, especially in that blanket area, the New Age, where people profess to have powers that they don't have and promise to teach you how to be a shaman in a weekend if you pay $500 or $2,000. So one has to be very careful not to be taken in by anyone who says they can do something. A lot of people are fakes. There is a lot of charlatanism, and there is a lot of pretense in all this. I think this is why scientific world, the academic world, is very loath to go into this too much because of these possibilities. So there is a lot of commercialization. Also, people in tribal groups can be quite damaged by New Agers or experimenters fascinated with the topic. I don't blame them for being fascinated with the topic, but they can actually change a tribal group, tribal group's culture and whole way of life by going in and taking their own drugs in to a community that might have just used one particular plant hallucinogen according to their own cultural precepts. So that aspect has to be taken into consideration when we're discussing this type of thing. I talk about that in the last chapter of the book, What is the Nature of Reality, and being a little bit careful about opening the wrong doors. Yes, so I think that's a really good question, Jeff, for listeners to be very careful about this, all that kind of thing.
What your research is showing me, it's a very interesting interaction when you have a belief, and it's between the brain and mind and outside reality and those the power of beliefs in general.
Yes, the power of belief. Belief's very strong. Well, it can make us go to war. Belief is intrinsic to all this, of course. And as I said before, the cultural filters on an experience and the way the experience is interpreted. So the belief colours the basic experience. The belief can induce the experience. It's a combination of a lot of things. You have to look at a lot of different perspectives.
It is quite amazing how vulnerable we are as human beings, vulnerable to suggestion in altered states. And many listeners know that religions and certain groups will take advantage of that.
Yes, and one can be coerced into believing something. One can be coerced into acting in a certain way. What I'd like to mention here is the idea of set and setting. This is important in any activity like this because to engage intentionally in something like this, you have to be a very balanced individual. And set, S-E-T, refers to the state of mind that you're in when you're doing something like this. And it's really important to be completely relaxed and to be in a good psychological space. It's not a good idea to go into something like this with fear and trepidation and or in an angry mood or doing something like this because you want to get power over somebody or for any untoward reason. So the psychology of it is very important, as it says. Setting is the environment that you're in when you're engaged in something like this. So that's also very important. So setting up a space properly, being out in the environment in a beautiful area, being with people that you feel confident with, and all this is very important as well. Don't be exploited. Don't allow yourself to be taken in by somebody just because they can do something, say they can do something. Caution and being aware of your own natural capabilities and confidence.
Dr. Lynn Hume, author of Portals, Opening Doorways to Other Realities Through the Senses. You have a new book out titled The Varieties of Magical Experience, Indigenous, Medieval, and Modern Magic. You wrote this with Neville Drury. Where can listeners find this book?
It's published by ABC Clio, which is out of Santa Barbara in California. So if you go to the ABC Clio site, you can order it directly from the publisher. That's www.abc-clio.com, or just pull up The Varieties of Magical Experience, Google in that, and it should come up as well. Amazon.com, you can order it, and you can order it through local bookstores.
Dr. Lynn Hume, thank you so much for being on Another News.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.
And my shadow strolling down the avenue. Me and my shadow, not a soul to tell my troubles to. And when it's 12 o'clock, we climb the stairs. We never knock, because there's nobody there, just me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue. Shadow, all alone.